Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hi, I'm Lauren Sherman, the host of Fashion People. I love fashion, obviously, but shopping for fashion online is kind of annoying. There's endless scrolling, my size is always out of stock, and I can't actually find what I want. No one has really made this work for me. That is until List. Instead of browsing different stores one by one, on List you can see and shop all of the best fashion. List is the secret shopping weapon now used by all my most stylish, cool, and in-the-know friends. Don't shop around. Join 200 million fashion shoppers, including me, on List.com. That's L-Y-S-T. Or download the List app on the App Store today.
Well, we're going to get out of the gate with a guest who literally influenced me many years ago when I read a couple of his books. He joins us now on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline from France, of all places, across the pond. Eddie L. Harris, one of the top African-American authors who wrote Mississippi Solo and South of Haunted Dreams and other books. And Eddie L. Harris, thanks so much for joining us. It's really an honor to talk to you because when I read Mississippi Solo many years ago, it had a deep impact on me.
You make me feel really old, somehow.
and you know, we've all aged a bit, but for our listeners who may not be familiar with that book, you grew up in St. Louis, Missouri, went to Stanford, and one day you came to the conclusion you wanted to canoe the entire Mississippi from Lake Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico, and you had never canoed before. How did that all happen?
Well, it was a low period in life when I was trying to be a writer and nothing was getting published, nothing was happening, and I decided to do something to shake things up, and for some reason popped into my head canoeing the Mississippi River. I was always a fan of the river. I love it. I've done it. I did it a second time. I'm not sure if you know this. I did it a second time a couple of years ago.
Yeah, I was looking at your video a few hours ago, and I was impressed by that as well. And obviously, growing up in St. Louis, you have a connection to the Mississippi River with the Gateway Arch and all the bridges that go into Illinois and things like that. But I know that in the book, you talked about it early on when you put the canoe into the river at Lake Itasca. And, of course, it's just a trickle coming out of the lake at that point.
Yeah.
And you had trouble getting under the footbridges. And then I love your story about when you got to Lake Bemidji. And you got out to walk around the city, and you came back, and the canoe was gone. And you thought it was stolen, didn't you?
I did think it was stolen. I was not. You were right when you said I had no canoeing experience. I had no idea that the water could come up and just take my canoe away.
And so, if I remember right, Eddie, so you're walking around Bemidji, and you're an African-American male, and of course, it's a predominantly white city, northern Minnesota. And a white woman stops in her pickup truck and offers you a ride, and you tell her the canoe got stolen, and she said, "You know what? Well, we don't steal up here."
That's right. her name was Emily. I wish I knew where she was.
Oh, yeah. So a fabulous book. I want to get into that and other stuff as we continue in the interview. But I thought of you with the George Floyd tragedy, because you have written about race relations in the U.S. And again, unbelievable stuff in your books and your video. What have been your takeaways? You're in France now. I know there were protests over there recently regarding the George Floyd tragedy. How do you view this?
Well, yeah, I'm in France right now, but I just came back. I was in quarantine or confinement in the States for the last 2-3 months. It's certainly a tragedy. It seems as if for every step forward we take another or two steps backward. We just can't seem to get it right. And you put this on top of the incident in Louisville, Kentucky, the incident in Georgia, and all the other incidents combined. And, of course, there's bound to be a pressure cooker explosion at some point. And I think that's what we're living now. The expectation, my expectation, is that we come out of this thing a little bit better than we did after the Rodney King explosion and after the Ferguson, Missouri explosions. But we just can't seem to stay on the right path permanently for some reason. And I just don't understand why that is.
Yeah, and we've hit the boiling point, as you said, Eddie. And we're all hoping that George Floyd is the tipping point. But we don't know. As you said, I thought the same thing about Rodney King. And I thought the same thing about Philando Castile here in the Twin Cities a few years ago. One of your other books was South of Haunted Dreams, and I read that as well, where you got on a motorcycle and drove around the South to see if there had been changes for the better in race relations. That was a few years ago. In 2020, how would you classify race relations in the U.S.?
I don't know if you can classify race relations in the U.S. with a broad brush. It's very complicated. It's very individual. It's very regional. It's certainly better than it was 50 years ago, 40 years ago, probably even 15 years ago. As I said, though, I think what happens is we make these steps forward, and then somehow we back up. Obama's election was a massive step forward. What we're living now, I feel sometimes, is the kind of retribution for having elected a black president. And once we get through this period, ever the optimist, I am absolutely convinced that we will come out on the better side. I don't know how long that better side will continue, but I'm absolutely sure it will be better than what we're doing right now.
Why is some of white America, not all, some of white America afraid of the African-American male? And I ask this question because of part of the book, South of Haunted Dreams. I remember it vividly when you describe, you're riding into a small town on your motorcycle. I forget what state, it may have been Mississippi. But you get out, and I think you wanted to get lunch. In the middle of the day, it's broad daylight, and you're walking around in your motorcycle outfit.
Yeah.
And you talk about crossing the street, and a white woman pulls up, and you can hear her hit the power lock button. And then you go down to the lake and look into the lake at your own reflection, and you ask the question, why are people afraid of me? And I sat with that paragraph for decades, Eddie. Explain that to me.
I wish I could. I wish I could. If we could pinpoint the reason for the fear, we could tackle the fear. Part of it, I'm absolutely sure, comes from the imagery that we get on television and in the movies since the beginning of television and the beginning of movies. The representations of black people have always been either buffoonery or fear. And the fear factor seems to overarch everything else. And why it is, I don't know. Is it fear of masculinity, fear of stealing my job, stealing my woman, stealing my something? But throughout the Atlantic slave trade, for example, I am sure that fear was ingrained that black Mr. Big Black Man is going to wake up in the middle of the night, steal into my house, and cut my throat. And we perpetuated those images in order to keep black people oppressed. That's all I can come up with. There have been efforts for a while, black people were always the bad guy on TV. And then there was an effort to make black people always the judge or the cop. But we've never had a moment where black people could just be black people, just be people. There's always some representation that goes along with being black as opposed to just being a person. So if you're black, you always have to think about being black. And if you're white, you're always thinking about that guy as being black as well. There's something about the way we live in this society that makes that contrast, that starkens out that contrast. and I don't know what to do about it.
Eddie L. Harris, our guest here on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus Hotline. It's Overnight Minnesota on Newstalk 830 WCCO. That moment in that southern city in the middle of the day when you heard the woman hit the power lock button because she saw you, an African-American male, and immediately she was afraid. How often do you deal with that, Eddie?
Well, over here I don't deal with it at all. When I'm in the States, now that I'm an older person with gray hair and a big white beard, nobody, it doesn't have the same... I apparently don't project the same image as I did when I was younger and my beard was totally black. So it doesn't happen so much. And I also feel that people are a little bit more conscious of it, and so they won't do it as overtly as they used to. But you can still see the fear in people's eyes in certain places. When you're in the subway in New York City, nobody's paying attention to you. But when you're walking down a small town in northern Minnesota, maybe it's different. And I can't put it all down to racism. Some of it's just, there's a guy I don't know. Let's have a look and see who that guy is. And that will happen here, too. People will look at you and, what are you doing in this particular spot where we never saw another black person before? But it isn't always racism. Sometimes it's curiosity. But we have to, I think, as Americans, get past the point where everything falls back on race. It isn't always about race. A lot of it is, of course, but not everything. And until we can get those blinders off, those blinkers off of our eyes, we will always be focused on that one aspect of the person in front of me. That, I think, is the capital for us to get through to the next level of how we're going to be Americans. Part of the problem, speaking of being Americans, I think part of that problem is right there. We, as black people, are not fully American in the eyes of a lot of white people. Probably in the eyes of a lot of black people, too. That, I think, is what the American dream ought to be. How do we become fully American, not only to ourselves, but in the eyes of our co-citizens. That's what we should be striving for. And for the Republican Party to continue to insist on mechanisms that limit voting, what we should be doing is finding a way to make a true democracy and enlarging the voting field so that people do feel that they have a stake in the country, in the electoral process, and in everything that goes on in America, instead of having all of these little segments of society. This is mine, that's yours, this is somebody else's. It should all be mine. And one of the reasons I canoed the river the second time was to underscore that this is my river and that there is nothing that happens in this country that I'm not part of. I can do anything that anybody else can do, or I should be able to do anything that anybody else can do without fear, without remorse, and without constraint.
Yeah, and the thing I really loved about Mississippi Solo, your ability to take an otherwise mundane, average moment in time and write about it and make it come to life. The situation where you lost the canoe at Lake Bemidji. And as the white woman in Bemidji told you, hey, you have to tie the canoe down, and she drove you to the other side of the lake and you found it coming out the other side of the Mississippi. You know, again, this is a long time ago, but I remember it vividly. And I read the book Blue Highways by William Least Heat Moon, another similar book to Mississippi Solo. So you have that ability. Do you feel like, I mean, I know you went to Stanford, came out of St. Louis, have achieved a lot, you've written books, you've done this video on the Mississippi River. Has Eddie L. Harris achieved the American dream?
I am the American dream, and I think part of it is, what we have to look at is individuals as opposed to collectives. And the stories that we hear about are mostly the stories of the collective. On an individual level, on an individual basis, and this is what I discovered not only on the Mississippi River, but also in South of Haunted Dreams. One-on-one, people are, Americans in general, are fantastic. It's when we start thinking of ourselves as part of a group that things go somehow haywire. But if you're canoeing down the Mississippi River, a black man alone, why would you not be afraid? Except for the fact that every person you meet, black or white or anything else, is kind to you. So on an individual basis, the world that I see is the American dream. All of these people who see me, who greet me, who welcome me, who invite me, who just have a cup of coffee with me, they treat me as some crazy person in a canoe, not as a black person. We've got to somehow see ourselves as individuals instead of only as a piece of a group. And when that happens, I shouldn't say we have to do these things. But in my personal experience, when I do these things, when I'm just me out in life, the response I get is brilliant. So if one were to look at my life as a black man doing what I do, one would think that, wow, racism had disappeared a long time ago. Which is, of course, not true at all. It's just, as an individual, I live my life in such a way that these things somehow have vanished. Or not vanished, but at least don't affect me the way it seems to affect the collective. So maybe we should all get in a canoe or all get on a motorcycle and cruise around and just start meeting people one-on-one. One-on-one, America is probably the best place on the planet.
Yeah, and I love the fact you have a sense of curiosity. You want to get to know people. I love the fact that you're a traveler, because I love to go places. I've always said there's no such thing as a bad road trip. I believe it was in Mississippi Solo, maybe it was south of Haunted Dreams. You described going to a party, and somehow the narrative turned to, there's not a lot of African Americans on the ski slopes or the hiking trails or maybe water skiing in northern Minnesota on one of our 10,000 pristine lakes. And I've noticed that too. I love to hike out in the Rocky Mountains or Glacier Park or wherever. Why is that, Eddie? I mean, it shouldn't be that way. I mean, as you said, it's everybody's America. Everybody should be in the Colorado Rockies on a hiking trail and looking out at the most majestic scene you could possibly imagine. Why is it mostly white?
I did a magazine piece for Outside Magazine about this same thing a long time ago called Solo Faces. And it examines that very issue. And part of the reality is financial. It costs money to go from St. Louis to Colorado to ski. If the economic situation is such that black people are more or less advantaged than white people, of course you're going to see more white people doing things that cost money. Secondarily, because we only represent 11% of the population, on the ski slopes, there might be 11% of the skiers being black. And if that's the case, sure, it looks like the slopes are all white, not just the snow, but the white skiers as well. When in fact, the sprinkling of black people that you do see on the slopes represent 11%, or maybe a little less than 11% because of the financial factor. So it's easy to just look at the situation and say black people don't do this and black people don't do that. But I think black people are doing those things. We just don't recognize it. And the ones who don't either don't want to, don't like to, or are afraid to do them. It is, even though my experience down the Mississippi River and my experience on my motorcycle and every other experience I have out in the wilderness and the crazy places of America alone have been fantastic, it is not unreasonable to think that I'm crazy. A black person out on the river, all sorts of bad things can happen. And, of course, there was a bad incident in Mississippi when I was canoeing down the Mississippi River. That fear is part of the makeup of being black in America. There is a fear of being out the way the jogger in Georgia was back in February, March. You never know when you're going to go jogging if some redneck in his pickup truck is going to sneak up behind you and do some harm to you. Or this guy walking down the street in some rural town in Texas gets picked up by a couple of guys in a pickup truck and dragged to death behind the car. So it is not unreasonable to be afraid. And once you start to be afraid, if that fear turns into a kind of collective fear, then yeah, you're just going to stay home and enjoy the safety of numbers. That is part of it. So financial, population representation, and the fear factor. I think all of those things combine. And the fact that we're not invited to go do these things. When I wrote that article for Outside Magazine, in the article, I mentioned that REI and Sierra somebody, the Sierra Club, and all of them, most of their sponsors. You never see black representation in the adverts. And if I, as a black person, am thumbing through that magazine, it looks like the outdoor world, is for white people. So on some level, it is the invitation is missing for these companies that make tents, that make clothing, that make equipment. They need to start pinpointing a black population that says, come and join us, do what we do, and you will enjoy it too. So that's another factor I think that's missing.
And last time I checked, their money is green. So you can cash the checks and all that good stuff. A couple more thoughts, Eddie. And again, very grateful you would join us here on Overnight Minnesota. The George Floyd thing. It started as a bonfire here in the Twin Cities, 38th in Chicago and South Minneapolis, which has turned into ground zero, sacred ground. And it quickly became a wildfire, and it's gone global. Because, as you said, we've had many other incidents before George Floyd. Why does this one feel a little bit different and seem a little bit bigger in scope?
Well, as you said, it has gone global. There have been protests in New Zealand, of all places.
Wow.
And in Paris, of course, and in Bordeaux, just down the road from where I am right now. It's gone global because of possibly two things, one of which is the cell phone. The fact that Chauvin is captured on video kneeling on this guy's neck is important, because not only do you see the incident itself, you don't see the whole thing, but you do see the expression of this guy that says, yes, I'm on video, I'm on candid camera, and I don't care. That's the look in his eye. If you pay close attention, what you see is a man who seems to not care that you know what he's doing. Most of our evil deeds we try to do in the dark. This guy is saying, this is an evil deed maybe, but I don't care if you see me doing it. I think that has exploded the consciousness of people watching the thing. The other possible, just possible factor, is that at this moment in time, even though Donald Trump has been running around saying we're going to make America great again, what he has actually done is put America back in the 1960s, when the rest of the world was protesting along with Martin Luther King, saying that injustice in America is intolerable. What he has done, because of his performance and his comportment, what Donald Trump has done is reduced American prestige and influence. And people now are pointing at this incident as representative of what's happening globally in America. This is just another element of America's losing its place in the world. So you've got the cell phone, and you've got this anti-American rhetoric or anti-American sentiment that's running around the world, and it comes down to, let's protest in the rest of the world the way we protested against the Vietnam War and against white racism in Alabama in the 1960s. And it's interesting that the cell phone is so relevant, the cell phone video. Even the incident in Georgia, I don't know if the response would be the same. In fact, 3 months ago, nobody was talking about that story.
It was covered up.
Until the video surfaced.
Yep.
So we're doing all these crazy things and getting caught doing them. And now it is inescapable of how racist we can sometimes be. And it affects us. What's really interesting about this new, or what's interesting about the new feeling of this new protest is how many white people are protesting too.
Yeah.
So I think we finally come to a point where we recognize that this is untenable. We cannot continue like this. And everybody, I think, is feeling it. And I hope that's the case. I hope everybody is feeling it and finally stands up and says enough is enough.
We have just a few seconds. I want to end on a little bit lighter note. When you took the second canoe journey down the Mississippi from Lake Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico, and you did the documentary a few years ago, did you get hit by a flying Asian carp? Because I saw that video. When they were flying out of that river.
Oh, Lord Almighty. I was attacked several times by those things.
And where was that? Was that Minnesota? Was that Wisconsin, Illinois? It had to be upper Mississippi.
That was down near Illinois, on the Illinois side.
Okay. Okay.
But I did run into the carp up near, just below La Crosse, Wisconsin, between La Crosse and Minnesota.
Yep.
And I ran into those carp all the way down until the confluence with the Ohio River.
Wow.
It is frightening, and I think it's going to be I don't know how much lighter this is, but it's a devastating environmental occurrence for the Mississippi River Basin.
And I'm going to get you on again, because I love to talk about the state of the river, if you will, and we'll get into that and more. But, Eddie, thanks so much for joining us from across the pond in France. You're a treasure. Your books literally impacted me, and I wish you nothing but the best.
Thank you, Eric. I will talk to you soon.
All right, very good. He's Eddie L. Harris, one of the top African-American authors. He wrote Mississippi Solo, South of Haunted Dreams. I urge you to read those books. He came to you on the CenterPoint Energy Home Service Plus hotline.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.